Welcome to The Green Investor, powered by Investopedia. I'm Caleb Silver, the editor-in-chief of Investopedia and your host on our journey into what it means to be a so-called green investor and what is happening across the sustainable investing landscape. On this week's episode, we take a deeper dive into activist investing as Michael O'Leary of Engine No. 1 joins the show. Engine No. 1 has been forcing change at companies, including ExxonMobil and General Motors, by taking large equity positions in those companies and sometimes installing its own board members to really change their strategies. That's coming up in just a few minutes. But first, let's set some ground rules for this podcast. This podcast is, of course, for informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. We will not make recommendations to buy, sell, or hold a particular security or asset, although we may discuss financial products with our guests. Some of our guests may invest in the securities mentioned on this podcast. Some of our guests may sell or market securities mentioned on this podcast, but all listeners should do their own research or consult with their financial advisor or broker before making any investment decisions. Let's do the news, shall we? Well, the mega drought that gripped the American West in 2021 led to the driest year in at least 1,200 years and is a worst-case climate change scenario, according to a new study released in the journal Nature Climate Change. The study, led by Park Williams, a climate hydrologist at UCLA, said the mega drought was worse than the mega droughts of the late 1500s and shows no signs of easing in the future. The report also says that 55% of the U.S. West is in drought, with 13% of the area experiencing the two highest drought levels ever recorded. Oceans along the U.S. coastline will rise faster within the next three decades than they did in the past 100 years, bringing more flooding to coastal cities such as New York and Miami, according to the latest projections from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA as we call it. Sea levels are expected to rise as much as 12 inches or 30 centimeters by the year 2050, according to NOAA's report. While the amounts vary according to region, the inundation will lead to more coastal flooding and make tidal and storm surges more severe. The never-ending battle against greenwashing continues, and the latest salvos have been fired by the European Securities and Markets Authority. The ESMA, as it is called, issued a report last week saying that it has observed a, quote, mismatch between what fund managers are telling ESG clients and their actual allocation strategies. This is happening just as Morningstar removed the ESG label from over $1 trillion in investment funds, saying they don't meet adequate environmental, social, and governance standards. Keep an eye on this space, folks. The lines around what is and what isn't ESG are getting more defined as regulators pay more attention to greenwashing. BP is trying to reassure investors that declining oil and gas production won't cripple earnings for the remainder of the decade as the British energy giant pivots to lower carbon investments. BP's executive team tried to provide these reassurances following BP's quarterly earnings report in early February, in which it reported a steep spike in profits as oil prices topped $90 per barrel. BP reported an underlying replacement cost profit of $4.1 billion in the fourth quarter. In the oil industry, the underlying replacement cost represents how much it would cost to replace the value of the assets BP holds, including its oil reserves. BP reported a full-year underlying replacement cost profit of almost $13 billion, which was the strongest profit in nearly a decade for the company. BP says it plans to cut fossil fuel production by 40% by 2030 from 2019 levels. Meanwhile, it is increasing low-carbon investments in areas including electric vehicle charging stations, hydrogen, and bioenergy. Executives said a couple weeks ago that these so-called transition growth businesses will consume around 50% of total capital spending by 2030, which is an increase of more than 40% by 2025. A new report published by the New Climate Institute and Carbon Market Watch finds that 25 of the world's most valuable companies, including Alphabet, Amazon, and Nestle, are making climate-related promises that they aren't even close to keeping. These global companies, which together accrued $3.2 trillion in revenue in 2020 and accounted for 5% of the global greenhouse emissions in 2019, have climate plans that are weaker than how they've been marketed so far, according to the report. AP Moller, Maersk, Vodafone, and Deutsche Telekom are the only ones on track to near complete decarbonization, according to the report, which we will link to in the show notes. Calls for shareholder divestment grew louder last year. There were 1,485 institutions with $39 trillion of assets publicly committed to some form of divestment from fossil fuels in 2021, up from 181 institutions with only $52 billion in 2014. That's according to one tally by a coalition of environmental and consumer advocacy organizations. The New York State Common Retirement Fund was one of the latest to commit, announcing recently that it would divest $230 million away from 21 energy firms, including Chesapeake Energy and Diamondback Energy. Europe's largest lenders may face some backlash for not living up to their pledge to stop financing oil and gas operations. Share Action, which is a London-based nonprofit known for pushing climate change resolutions at HSBC Holdings and Barclays, says European banks provided $55 billion of funding to companies expanding their oil and gas projects in 2021. While that's down from $106 billion in 2020, it's in line with pre-pandemic averages, showing the slow pace of change as the industry looks to move away from fossil fuel financing. The biggest European provider of fossil finance in 2021 was HSBC, which pumped $8.7 billion into oil and gas expansion at companies like ExxonMobil and Saudi Aramco. And it's Back to the Future for DeLorean. The infamous gull-wing car that starred in Back to the Future is being resurrected in Texas by a group of executives who are associated with the electric vehicle startup Karma Automotive in China. According to Bloomberg, they're working with Stephen Wine, who acquired the DeLorean branding rights in the 1990s and supplies parts for the 6,000 or so remaining vehicles. There are passive investors who take positions in companies and hope for change as it relates to their climate and environmental initiatives. And then there are active investors who take big positions in public companies and try to drive change by taking board seats and demanding action. That's how Engine Number One rolls. It has emerged as one of the most effective activist investors to come on the scene in decades, and it's putting pressures on companies across industries. It has also launched two ETFs that help retail investors like us participate in its efforts. Michael O'Leary is the managing director of Engine Number One and our guest on The Green Investor this week. Welcome.
Thanks, Caleb. Excited to be here.
Michael, I gave the basics from 50,000 feet, but for the rest of us, explain what Engine Number One is as you see it and how it operates.
Engine Number One is an investment firm focused on the connection between a company's social and environmental impact and its ability to create long-term value for shareholders. And so this starts with better measurement by trying to assess exactly what is the value that companies create or destroy for their employees, for their customers, for communities, for the environment, and then trying to connect that value to core drivers of business success. And then finally, trying to focus on what we can do as active owners to help companies improve, to help companies create more value for their stakeholders, ultimately for their shareholders as well.
Yeah, you're trying to drive value, but you're trying to drive value along with your alignments around the environment, around social issues, around governance. So you're in it to actually get returns, but you want to make change as well, which is a different model than a lot of people approach. So how do you do it?
Yeah, I think oftentimes, you know, ESG gets boxed off as a separate set of issues, is somehow disconnected from financial drivers or disconnected from business value. Part of the problem is that right now, most investors think in dollars and cents. They're building financial models in Excel. They're trying to model out the future growth of markets, of market share, of profitability. And then you come along with an ESG rating or an ESG ranking, and it can be difficult to see how those two things are connected. You know, the company's value to stakeholders and its ability to create value for shareholders as well. And so our first approach is something we call our total value framework, which is let's try and measure in dollar terms these other sources of value that companies have for their stakeholders. Easy one, easy example is with carbon emissions. Let's try and measure the amount of carbon a company emits into the atmosphere, put a social cost of carbon on that, and then put that in the context of the P&L. And that helps to show whether or not something like carbon emissions is de minimis, you know, it doesn't make a difference to the company, or is actually a huge factor. This is this idea of materiality that often gets talked about within the realm of ESG, and that's what we're trying to focus on, is these material issues. Now, how do we then, through those insights that we derive, actually drive change at companies? This is the broader world of what I would call active ownership, which is three buckets would be the votes we cast at annual meetings, would be the engagements we can do with companies, and then all the way up to and including the sorts of activist campaigns that you saw from us with Exxon last year, and that in many ways has always been a part of the traditional investor toolkit, and increasingly is being part of the ESG investor, impact investor toolkit as well.
Right. So you're taking positions in companies, you're taking board seats sometimes as well to really drive that change. So this is not, guys, we're going to stop investing if you don't do what we want. You want the change and you want these companies to succeed in making that change. So what kind of pressure, let's talk about Exxon, but what kind of pressure have you been able to exert on companies and what has that change brought about?
So it's such a good point on, you know, oftentimes people talk about this escalation path. Of first you have a friendly meeting with management and then maybe you'll send a public letter. And the problem is for most investors, the end, the highest escalation you can get to is you sell the stock. And that is not much of a threat to management to say your noisiest, loudest investor who's putting the most pressure on you has now traded places with some other investor by selling your shares to someone else on the secondary market. I think the divestment movement that's particularly been focused on oil and gas and climate issues, the divestment movement has been unbelievably effective as a movement at creating huge amounts of focus on climate for investors. You look at just the sheer dollars of assets that have committed to divestment, something like $25 billion in the mid-2010s, now $13, $14 trillion of assets. But what it's now allowed us to do is focus on climate from the divestment movement. Is it allowed us to take a step farther on the engagement path to say for investors who are still in these companies, you know, for whom now, because of the divestment movement, climate is a front and center issue. Can we make the case that a given company is destroying shareholder value by not focusing enough on the climate? So that is, I think, in its clearest case, what escalation can look like. As you say, companies, public companies are run like little corporate republics where shareholders elect boards, boards appoint CEOs, CEOs execute strategy, ultimately on behalf of shareholders. And so our idea is that if that company is now not operating in a way that actually benefits those long-term investors, it's up to the investor to vote, to engage, and sometimes to even replace boards so that it will.
Right. And you've been able to do that, not necessarily replace boards, but get into those boardrooms where you're affecting decisions. So can you give us the ExxonMobil as a case study for what you wanted going in and what you're trying to achieve by taking position there?
The case behind the Exxon campaign in some ways was very simple. It was, if you are the fifth largest greenhouse gas emitter in world history, as Exxon was, and 2/3 of your revenue is coming from countries that have themselves set or are setting net zero targets, you don't have a sustainability problem. You don't have an ESG problem. You have a core strategic problem. And that one thing you can see with Exxon versus its peers historically was that as other companies were starting to reckon with the energy transition and try to understand how they are going to be able to create value, even as the world works to decarbonize, that Exxon was behind. And that Exxon's leadership, even at the board level, was an extremely impressive group of individuals with the backgrounds leading some of the largest companies in the world, but lacked an energy background relevant to actually helping to navigate this transition. And so December of 2020, we had put forth a slate of four new directors. All of them had deep energy experience, but understood how you'd have to approach an opportunity like Exxon to help them transform their business in many ways so they can succeed, not just for the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, but long into the future as they've succeeded in the past. That campaign went all the way through to the annual meeting in the spring of last year, and ultimately we were successful in putting three new directors on the board. The reality is Exxon, like any company that has long-lived capital assets, like any company in the oil and gas space, looks the way it looks today, has the emissions profile that it has today because of decisions that were made 5, 10, 15 years ago. And so the goal was never some sort of radical break with history. The goal is to reposition its strategy, its future, so that 5, 10, 15 years from now, it can be succeeding in a world that is decarbonizing.
Super challenging when companies are managing for the bottom line, though. The executives at ExxonMobil are thinking about quarterly earnings. They're also long-term invested in their business because these are long-cycle businesses. You can't just go explore a well and dig it up in a couple of weeks and be pumping oil. This is long-cycle businesses, capital-intensive businesses, heavy investments, and heavy risk. Our listeners will remember episode one with Spencer Glennon. We're talking about trillions of dollars of risk, not just in the companies and their assets themselves, but in the investment in these companies themselves. So these are evolutionary changes you are trying to bring about, not revolutionary change your business model on the spot. They'll die if they do, but they'll die if they don't. Right, Michael?
The kind of a finance 101 view here would be to say their job is to make certain assumptions about the future of oil demand, the future of oil prices, and then based off of those assumptions, try and maximize risk-adjusted return on a project-by-project basis. And part of the argument we were trying to make in our campaign was that the assumptions they were using on what the world was going to look like a year from now and 5 years from now and 50 years from now were not just out of step with what we might think or what other folks focused on climate or sustainability might think. They were out of step with their competitors, out of step with industry organizations, with government estimates, with academics. And so part of the goal was to say the decisions made today about projects will continue to live for years, if not decades, need to be based off of reasonable expectations about how the world is or is not going to achieve its climate ambitions. You know, I think that that's one thing that's worth keeping in mind, that as an investor, we still have to be grounded in reality. We have to be grounded in the energy transition, exactly how long that will take, how hard that will be, and understand what it will take to actually create value through that transition for companies who are entirely in traditional energy, entirely in renewable energy, those trying to transition or mix between the two. And all of which is not to say we've got all the answers, but that we think we understand the sort of leaders you would want in the boardroom to be making those decisions.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about investors in general, because this is a reasonable way of approaching these companies to make change that they have to make ultimately. But investors have kind of changed the way they think, and I'm painting with a broad brush, over the last 5 to 10 years as it relates to ESG, as it relates to climate change, as it relates to their sensibilities. They're investing with their moral and ethical sensibilities, but they're also thinking long-term as well. I want to be invested in companies that are going to be here in 10 years. How have you noticed that change in terms of the clients that have come in to Engine Number One and the people you're dealing with now?
It's amazing the degree to which climate has sort of become this big tent issue, where you would be hard-pressed today to find a corporate leader or an investor who did not at least pay lip service to the idea that companies need to understand how to navigate energy transition. And that's not just within the oil and gas sector. That is across auto and transportation, across agriculture, across building, across industry, across consumer packaged goods. That industry after industry is going to be transformed over the coming decades as the world reckons with climate change. And you've got big traditional researchers putting out figures that say it's going to require $2-4 trillion per year in incremental spending to be able to reach net zero by 2050. That's the investment opportunity of a generation, you know, of my generation, surely as a millennial. And so I think it's no longer, you don't have to make the strong case anymore that focusing on climate is important for investing. I think a lot of people have come to recognize that. And one of the data points I'd point to is if you look at shareholder voting every year at annual meetings, this past year, there were 11 proposals at public companies on climate issues that passed, that got over majority support. That compares to 3 in 2020 and 0 in 2019. It's remarkable to think that as recently as 2019, not a single proposal on climate issues was successful. And I think that dramatic change is indicative of a broader shifting mindset among investors that climate is a core and material issue for many companies.
And you know firsthand, this is not necessarily generational. Yes, younger investors may have this sensibility, but older investors like me, and even older than me, who have been investing for a very long time, they're waking up to this as well, right? This is not just a young people thing.
No, you see, there's a great Morgan Stanley report that comes out every year, a survey asking, you know, how important is sustainable investing to you, start doing sustainable investing. And there's always been, since they started doing it, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, there's always been some differences across generations. But the trend that swamps all of that is that all generations, millennial, Gen X, boomer, everyone is increasingly interested in sustainable investing to the point now where if it's, you know, 80% of the population at large, it's nearly 99% of millennials. And so this is a wave that is in many ways has already crashed across the capital markets, this interest in ESG and sustainable investing.
Absolutely. It is here. And Engine Number One's brought a couple of ETFs, exchange traded funds, to the market to help retail investors like me, like our listeners, access this. Let's talk about Vote and let's talk about the NetZ ETF. Start with Vote. How is it constructed? How is it performing? Give us a little sense of how that's made.
Yeah, so Vote in some ways is a radically simple idea. Most ESG investing today, nearly all ESG investing today, is about what you have in your portfolio. You know, what sectors do you exclude? How do you reweight companies based off of an ESG index? How do you decide what companies are morally virtuous or not, and how do you create a portfolio that reflects that? Our idea with Vote, with the Engine Number One Transform 500 ETF, it's called, is what if we defined ESG investing not by what's in your portfolio, but by what you do as an owner of those companies? And so VOTE, in many ways, is an extremely simple traditional index fund. It holds the 500 largest public companies in the US by market cap. So it looks nearly identical to what a lot of investors already have in their 401ks, already have in their portfolios. What's different is if you go back since 2015 and look at the average S&P 500 fund, the average S&P 500 fund voted against something like 85% of social and environmental proposals. This is on climate, on gender pay disparity, on human rights in the supply chain and deforestation, the whole host of racial equity, workforce issues, a whole host of ESG concerns. The average S&P 500 fund, where probably a lot of people who are listening have their money, voted against those proposals, mainly because the big trillion-dollar asset managers just tend to take a more traditional, deferential approach. VOTE is the exact opposite. VOTE has the same underlying holdings to what a lot of investors already have, but then takes a more social and environmental focused approach to how we vote those shares. We have supported over 90% of social and environmental proposals since launch, and then how we engage with those companies, including through work like what we've done at Exxon or that we're doing around the electric vehicle transition at GM and otherwise. So that's the idea. It's passive investing with a twist on ESG, not by changing what it holds, but by changing what it does.
Right. And you can look at the report card, so to speak, and the record of voting and what shareholders have done and what the company has done. And that's probably one of the things that's attractive, is that I actually want to see what's inside and I want to see how these companies have behaved according to the resolutions that have been proposed.
In my experience talking with investors, many investors, especially on the retail side, they don't even know that there are annual meetings happening where there are votes being cast on their behalf on issues they care about. And then once they realize that, they don't know that oftentimes their votes are being cast in a way that directly conflicts with their long-term interests and their values. And so our approach is not just to vote in a better way, but then to publish those votes real time on our website to try and put pressure on other investors, other managers to follow, and ultimately create a product that is simple, you know, that anyone can access, but that is trying to drive real impact, you know, directly in the companies we hold. Netsy is a super exciting, just launched product from Engine Number One. Most ESG funds that are more actively managed or more concentrated, you'll tend to see a lot of companies in those funds that are big solution providers, you know, that are disrupting an industry, that are high growth, really exciting companies. Our idea, though, with Netsy was that a lot of the value to be created through the transition across sectors is going to come from big incumbent players who are transforming, you know, who have figured out a strategy that puts them on a path to net zero and a path to create value while they're doing it. This is companies like General Motors that still today is one of the biggest emitters in the auto sector, no doubt, but has now made the ambition to go all electric by 2035, which, if they are successful, could take 200 million tons of carbon out of the atmosphere every year versus what would have happened otherwise. Companies like this, you know, for us, are a critical, critical part to actually achieving net zero. And in this product, which is a concentrated, actively managed fund trying to generate returns, in this product, we think by creating a portfolio of those sorts of companies puts us in a better position to try and deliver attractive returns to investors. That's the goal. And so if you look at the investing continuum from pure active to pure passive, a lot of ESG investing gets stuck straddling the middle, you know, where it's not quite a passive fund because it has real deviation. You know, it excludes certain sectors, it reweights from market cap. And so you can see, you know, it outperforms in 2020, it underperforms in 2021. Never by huge numbers, but enough you notice. But it's not quite active either because a lot of ESG funds are following an index or a simple approach that's unclear why that should generate enduring alpha for years. Our idea was, what if we could stay on those two ends of the spectrum, a pure passive product that's VOTE or a pure active product that's NetZ, in both cases trying to engage to create impact, but then investors can choose, is it, you know, a core equity holding in an index portfolio? Do they want a kind of a satellite exposure trying to earn outsized returns? In either case, it's an ESG approach or an impact-oriented approach, but it doesn't look much like most ESG investing today.
Yeah, folks, we're going to link to the fact sheets on both of those ETFs so you can check them out, because they are very different than what you'll see across the industry today. But to your point on GM, when GM made that declaration, when they pivoted hard and said, we're going to make this change, we've one of the best performing stocks of 2021, Ford too. So they either have to get in line or they can just be an also-ran, one of the great companies of the 20th century that never made it out. They look like they're making that move right now. So you're definitely having an impact there. I've heard you say that ESG investors should be defined by not what they hold, but what they do. And that is kind of what I'm feeling is the philosophy behind everything at Engine Number One. This is active in the fact that you are taking positions, but you're also, as an investment committee, looking at those companies where there is opportunity for them to transform themselves into companies that have sustainability for the future and don't degrade the environment. Is that a fair way to look at it? You're looking to make these changes and you think investors want that too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the core point here is that this is how, in today's market, we think we can create value for investors, and increasingly investors are recognizing that too. And so I think if for a long time, ESG was seen as adding in some new interests outside of financial interest, I think what we're getting to across the market today, and for sure where Engine Number One sits, is trying to show that these are the core factors you should be focused on. You know, your workers, the value you're creating for your customers, your communities, for the environment. These are the core factors, the core investments that companies should be making if they're trying to generate long-term returns for their shareholders.
So what's needed, Michael, in the industry to drive more change? Is it better education? Is it more rules? Is it more clarity on what ESG and SRI mean? Because as our listeners know, and as you know, you've been in the industry a while, so much ambiguity. It's alphabet soup when it comes to all the acronyms there. But what is it needed for more of this push, especially from the retail base, to get into this?
Ultimately, the public markets are a team sport for investors. During the Exxon campaign, we owned 2 basis points of the company, which meant unless we could convince 49.981% of our fellow shareholders that we were right, we were not going to be successful in placing any new directors on the board. And the same is true for all the shareholder proposals that we support. Ultimately, it's nice if we support it and the competition doesn't, and we can show this great competitive differentiation, but it doesn't get a whole lot done for companies or a whole lot done for stakeholders or the environment. And so we're in this kind of odd position of trying to actively erode our competitive advantage, try and push other shareholders, other asset managers to vote in a way that better aligns with the long-term interests, the kind of pro-social, pro-environmental interests of a lot of the end investor. Retail investors, I think this is an important point. Right now, something like 93% of every vote that's cast in S&P 500 company is being cast by an institution. That's BlackRock or Vanguard or State Street or us or a pension fund. Only 7% are being cast by individual retail shareholders. Part of the reason is because fewer than 1 out of 10 retail investors who own shares directly actually vote. You know, most people, they get the proxy statement, it goes right in the trash, or they archive it in their inbox. The reality is that a lot of these proposals are narrowly passing or are narrowly losing. I mean, there's something like a dozen proposals or more every year that it's just by a hair, a couple percentage points difference between success and not. And so one thing I'm starting to see is especially in the startup community, folks trying to make it easier for retail investors to vote. You saw the acquisition of Say Technologies from Robinhood. I think that's kind of a step in the direction of Robinhood saying this is going to be an area of greater interest. And so I think all investors should be thinking about two things. One is how they vote if they own shares directly, of course. And then two is, if they've got shares through funds, through an index fund or a mutual fund or otherwise, are those funds voting their shares in a way that align with the way they'd want it to? And if not, you know, should they be moving capital to someone who would?
The last year and a half has really broke that open as such a key issue, but it's a long time coming. So fascinating, folks. Check out what they're doing at Engine Number One. And Michael O'Leary, the managing director of Engine Number One, thanks so much for joining the Green Investor. Really fascinating.
Thank you, Caleb. Appreciate it.
It's time for Green Facts, our chance to dig into an interesting development or data point in sustainable investing, and this week we are going to boot camp. The U.S. Army may start marching to a greener beat. The Army just released a detailed climate strategy that includes everything from electrifying its fleet, training troops for climate threats, and creating protective microgrids for renewable energy installations around the world. According to the report issued by Army Secretary Christine Wormuth, the Army plans to achieve 50% reduction in net greenhouse gas pollution by 2030 compared to 2005 levels. It also plans to attain net zero greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050 and proactively consider the security implications of climate change in strategy, planning, acquisition, supply chain, and programming documents and processes. Among those issues the Army says it's planning for, the national security risks associated with climate migration and water scarcity. The Army is the largest part of the U.S. military forces inside the Department of Defense, which represents half of the energy use of the federal government and about half of its climate footprint. It's a fascinating report, and we are linking to it and all the other reports we cite on the show page you can find at investopedia.com/thegreeninvestor. It's time to play Unpack the Acronym, and this week we're giving you the Daily Double, two acronyms for the price of one. Only on The Green Investor will you get that. Our two acronyms from the alphabet soup we call green investing are the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, NZAMI, and the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, GFANZ. Let's start with NZAMI. The Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative is an international group of asset managers committed to supporting the goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 or sooner, in line with global efforts to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and to support investing aligned with net zero emissions by 2050 or sooner. Its members are the world's largest asset managers, including BlackRock, BNP Paribas, Allianz, and AXA, and I'm just at the top of the alphabet. More than 236 asset managers or partner institutions signed on to NZAMI, representing some $57 trillion in assets under management. What about GFANZ? That's the Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, GFANZ, which was launched in April 2021 by Mark Carney, the UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance, and the UK Prime Minister Johnson's finance advisor for COP26. The GFANZ says it is bringing together existing and new net zero finance initiatives in one sector-wide coalition and providing a forum for leading financial institutions to accelerate the transition to a net zero global economy. Its members include over 450 financial firms across 45 countries responsible for assets of over $130 trillion. You're going to find the biggest banks, insurers, and money management firms inside the GFANZ, just like the NZAMI. So many coalitions, so many acronyms, so many pledges, but the realities of climate change need action. Let's see if these groups can do something about it. Well, we'll go out this week, as we do every episode, celebrating this week in environmental history. And this week we're celebrating the birthday of Ernest Haeckel, born on February 16, 1834. Haeckel was a German biologist, naturalist, and philosopher, and he discovered thousands of new species and coined many terms in biology, including the term ecology, for the study of the interrelationship of species and the environment. Happy birthday, Ernest, and thanks for your work. And that'll do it for this episode of The Green Investor. Our special thanks to Michael O'Leary and the team at Engine Number One for the conversation. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you can, please rate us and leave a review wherever you are listening to The Green Investor and recommend us to your network if you like what you hear. We post full transcripts of all the conversations we have on this show, along with links to the studies and reports we mentioned. And you can find those on investopedia.com/The Green Investor Podcast. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a fresh episode. In the meantime, keep it green, and thanks for joining us.